This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And when it comes to investing, the smartest opportunities often lie in connections. Connections you can't see at first glance. That's why Interactive Brokers developed Connections, a powerful new tool that helps you explore how stocks, ETFs, bonds, futures, options, and even macroeconomic themes are all linked. Imagine analyzing a technology stock and instantly seeing its competitors, ETFs, all in the same place, or option strategies to manage risk, or exploring market-wide themes like carbon capture, housing, or interest rates, all in one integrated window, all at the same place in a view that makes it easy. With access to over 160 global markets, Interactive Brokers brings you insights and opportunities other platforms just can't match, because the best-informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Learn more at ibkr.com/connections.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed cuts as expected. The dot plot turns dovish. Markets, not much of a move, really, initially. The rug pulls, moving out of crypto and into IPOs. And we're talking taxes and crypto with our guest, Pat Camuso. All this and much more on episode number 939 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome back. Welcome back. It's been a pivotal week in the global markets. I mean, we're kicking things off with the Federal Reserve's long-anticipated rate cut. We know about that, of course. The first time in 2025, the Fed lowered its benchmark interest rates, and it was by 25 basis points this time. And that brought the target range to, 4 to 4.25%. Again, who knows why they've decided to do this range thing? Makes it a little more complicated than it is. And I always say, who gets the 4%? Who gets the 4.25%? That's the something the Fed's dealing with. Well, the move reflects this growing concern that's out there right now over what people are calling a softening, a weakening labor market. And at the same time, what we have is persistent energy-related costs and housing-related costs and, well, you know what that's called, food-related costs. It's called inflation. All these costs that are going higher is all related to inflation. And with the fact that we are seeing this right now, it's a big question how the Fed, in fact, didn't really make a decision at this point. And I think they just caved in with the jobs numbers they saw last week. So during this week, Chairman Powell, he signaled potentially two more rate cuts could be on the table by the year end. Pretty interesting. He waffled around during his conference and discussion from 2:30 to around 3:45, I guess it was, and talked about that, well, maybe this is just a step, maybe it's just a reset, maybe there's more, maybe there's not. The big question, though, is what are they going to do? What are they looking at? It does look like from every aspect of the discussion that it all really is going to depend on what happens with the labor markets. They look like they're going to once again allow for inflation to move, thinking that will just be temporary, or better said, that possibly, possibly we won't notice if it's slow enough and we're not going to have this big issue with regard to worrying about big spikes in inflation if it just stays around the 3% number. Now, there's also been some discussion about, well, maybe we'll change that target rate from 2 to 3. I don't think that's really going to happen. If it does, it would fully discredit the Fed because the rest of the world's at 2%. And the fact if they do that, they'll just shoot themselves in the foot by saying that really the data doesn't matter. They're going to do what they want at the time that they want. We do have the other factors that are going on. You can see concern in the environment, on other things like the dollar did spike initially, came down. We saw interest rates did come down. The 10-year was at about 4%. That was, I would say, for about a minute. After a little while, it kicked up again, and we saw towards the end of the week, it moved higher to about 4.12, 4.13. Point is that it did move above, and the actual interest rate on the longer term moved up as well. And gold moved up, 3,700. It hit new highs this week. Silver is moving just like we talked about last week with our guest, Peter Schiff. But it's not all about the Fed. You know, what happened with the Fed on Wednesday, markets went up, did really well, and it was like, wow, and then they came back down. Thursday was pretty good. Friday was just an okay day. That was fine. Nothing wrong with Friday. By the end of the week, though, everything was up. The things that are going on, well, we got the U.S. and China, right, striking a deal about TikTok, looking to put ownership under U.S. ownership, which would ease tensions and maybe potentially preserve one of the world's most, one of the most influential platforms out there. So this is going to be all about data transparency, a new oversight board that's based in the U.S., and they're talking about it. They got somewhere on Friday, but we'll see where that goes. There's also a lot of things happening. Great, right here in Fort Lauderdale, the Levant Center of Innovation hosted its fourth annual South Florida Innovation Day. Cool stuff. Structural financial products are making a comeback. So we saw about $200 billion being pushed into complex investment vehicles like reverse convertibles, auto callables. What does that mean? Why do I bring this up? What's the point? Do we care? Do I care? Do you care? I mean, you don't have that in your portfolio. Why do you care? What it really means to me is it's kind of a green light signal about the renewed confidence in markets, new innovation, yield-enhancing strategies, even among the concern that we all have about rate volatility. So what it really shows me is there's an appetite for risk. Now, you have to say, is there too much risk going into this? That's a consideration. That's something we need to think about. But it, when we see these kinds of things happening, you have to realize it doesn't just tamper down and blow up in day one. We know that a lot of the things that we've seen over the last year that have been really good have been playing out very nicely. While we all agree, I think we all agree, you agree, right? That we have too much debt. I mean, you can't not agree with that. There's way too much debt. The debt service that we have and the problem we have, even with rates coming down, is absurd, causing long-term damage, maybe not for you and me, but for our kids, our grandkids. Now, you've heard about this for years, but over the years, the big difference has been that there's been periods of time where we've had big debt and it's cleaned up. This almost looks, to a point, insurmountable. That's my biggest concern right now. Now, around the world, there's a lot going on too. China's bond market under major pressure right now. Did you see what's going on? Sovereign yields are surging. Investors are like, I'm out. Thank you. See you later. People's Bank of China looks like they may be forced to intervene because there's a major deflationary trend that's going on there. That's why their stock market has been doing so well, because there is this idea that they're going to step in and do all sorts of things. Meanwhile, it was mid-Friday afternoon, I saw that Japan, the Japanese, the Bank of Japan, BOJ, is going to look to actually step back from their rate hiking situation. And at the same time, though, with yields reaching multi-year, multi-decade highs on their bonds, they're also going to step back from buying ETFs on the open market and REITs, and in fact, start selling those. What's that going to do to that market? I think they're going to do that as a little test right now. We see more jobs cuts from manufacturers. Ford's cutting 1,000 jobs in Germany. Slower demand of the in the EU. In Africa, we saw that a note was out about startup debt financing has surpassed $1 billion, which overtook equities for the first time. Clean tech, fintech leading the charge, banks and development financial institutions stepping up where venture capitalists step back. And then in South Korea. We see that there's a bit of concern after that whole ICE raid we saw that detained 300 Korean workers at the Hyundai plant in Georgia. And there's a big question about, you know, you treat our people like this, that whole investment push, they had like $350 billion on the table. $350 billion, big ones. And maybe that's going to be pulled back. And then we got the rug pulls that are going on. You see what's going on with Gemini's IPO? So same thing with StubHub on Friday. So this Gemini IPO, the Winklevoss twins darling, was, you know, this big excitement. You know, we're going to enter the IPO market, which I think is rather funny. It's trading well below its initial offering price. And this is being compared to some of the other deals like we saw back when they had these IPOs come out and they just bombed. Initially went up, right? This was oversubscribed by 20 times. Price to $28 a share. Went up to, I don't know, 40 or something like that. Way below in the low 20s right now. The hype doesn't always translate into long-term value. And just because you like something, you think it's cool, doesn't mean the company actually is doing well. And then we got some other thing, right? What about Intel? Holy mackerel. This has got to be one of the sweetest deals ever. The U.S. government got in, got under market pricing for Intel by like $3. Then here comes NVIDIA. Jensen Huang does some kind of negotiation. He's in the... I think that the timing of the announcement was funny. He's had a delegation with U.S. and British royalty, British royalty, U.S. president, and a delegation of business people from the U.S. and in from England. And they're at there, and then all of a sudden we see this announcement, right? This broad year, multi-year collaboration, co-development of custom data center and PC products. NVIDIA is going to commit to $5 billion investment in Intel. So Intel goes up like 25%. Woohoo, everybody's excited. The government's got all sorts of money they made on this. NVIDIA made all sorts of money on this. And what about the rest of us? Why didn't we get a discount? I want a discount when I buy shares. I think the thing is really funny with how this went down and what's going down and how now we're picking and choosing winners. I have to have a separate discussion on this entirely. I'm not going to get into it. But the idea that the government stepped into this and then did a little wink, wink, nudge, nudge to NVIDIA to maybe get something going here. Not the way I like to see our capital markets operate. Let's just say that. And I guess we got to take a second to circle back because I know your thoughts on what you think and maybe what happened and my thoughts on what I think was going to happen with the Fed and the 25 basis point cut that went on here. And I didn't really think that even though Fed funds futures bets were all in on a 25 basis point cut, I get that. At the same time, still questionable in my mind if it was necessary. Clearly, there's no question that the data gives the Fed cover here, right? Because the employment numbers were crap and the revisions that we saw, terrible. You know, 900,000 people that weren't really employed are now employed or not employed and all this bad. Still the sticking point of inflation. And that speech that Powell did planted the seed. There could be more rates coming. But I would be very surprised if that's going to happen if inflation doesn't come down. And I suspect that we're going to continue seeing that inflation, just continues to be very sticky. Already we're seeing huge increase in refinance activity. Last week, there was like 58% increase. And that was only with a 30 basis point drop from the week before. So that's good. But what did that do for the housing market? Refis, good. Maybe they'll be able to help people with spending. Cost a bit. But by how much? Because if you think about it, it takes about a full percent to really benefit when you're doing a refi. And if it takes a percent, just hold on a second. If it takes a percent and rates were at 7, now they're at 6, maybe. But when was that? They bought a house only in the past couple, 3 years. Everybody else is still stuck. You have something from 5 years ago? much lower. You're not moving. So then you have to ask, where is it going from here? And again, ask yourself, why are rates going higher? Why have rates been going higher? Why is the dollar dropping? Why is gold to the moon? Why are some of the cryptos holding in so well and reaching new highs? These are the issues that you really need to stop for a second and say, you know, there's something there. Maybe not reflective in stock prices right now and enthusiasm, but there's something there that we need to be aware of. And that's how we are setting ourselves up in our portfolios for our clients. And I think that's something you should just start to think about and wonder if we are starting to reach the end of the potential for expansion of price earnings multiples to a point that it's getting fully stretched. And think about how you want to review your portfolio. I got to tell you, we have a few stocks in the portfolio in our TDI managed growth strategy, had just enormous weeks, enormous year. But this week, wow, moved hard on the upside. What did we do? Took a little profit on them. That's right. Take some profit. Nobody ever went broke taking a profit. We know that. We've heard it a million times. Do you act on it? Something to think about. Something to think about. All right, before we get forward with our guest, because I do want to talk to him because I have a lot of questions on crypto taxation, I want to mention once again, Interactive Brokers, our good friends there, because they're going to ask a question. I'm asking a question, and here it is. Will the Fed leave the rate unchanged at the October 29th, 2025 meeting? The yes forecast contract recently traded at 38%, and the no was at 61%. With Interactive Brokers forecast contracts, you could trade on future events like climate, the economy, or even politics. Pick yes or no. And if you're right, you earn a dollar. Forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Make your prediction. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. The last trading day for this contract is October 29th. Now about our guest, Pat Camuso. He is a CPA and the founder of Camuso CPA, an industry-leading firm working closely with cryptocurrency investors and Web3 businesses that was among the first CPA firms to specialize in crypto taxes back in 2016. And as a pioneer in this field, Pat was among the first firms to accept cryptocurrency as payment, setting a forward-thinking example in the accounting profession. He's the host of the Financial Frontier podcast, where he explores the latest trends in crypto, tax, and finance. And he also runs the Digital Asset Digest, a newsletter delivering insights on blockchain, digital assets, and tax compliance. He's the author of Navigating the NFT Sales Tax Maze, Wayfair 2.0, and Web 3.0, an essential resource for navigating sales tax in the digital asset space. So Pat Camuso, back on the air here. Thanks for joining me. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm great. Let's talk about an exciting topic, which is crypto, paired with a non-exciting topic and a miserable topic called taxes, right? Let's let's combine both of those things into one, because I think there's a lot of things that are important. But I want to go backwards. I want to talk about your beginnings. You've been into, I think you started, my recollection and some of the details of what I have is that you started in the area of crypto accounting back in about 2016, right?
Yep, I was doing crypto accounting and crypto taxes. Really one of the first CPAs and CPA firms out there doing it.
So aside from the fact that it was, because in 2016, we're talking about several years ago, it was still in its infancy, right? I mean, it was you know, you had to think about, first of all, if I go into this direct, well, you tell me, because if you go, you tell me, why did you go there? What was the spark?
Yeah, well, it is interesting because most people that were even investing in it back then will, brag about it. And to a degree, rightfully so, because it was the very early days. No one really believed in it. And I was just personally an early adopter to Bitcoin before launching my firm. So I was deeply a believer in Bitcoin, in decentralization, and in, you know, hard assets. And I really viewed Bitcoin as a digital form of that very early on. And because I got in it early on and got other people in it early on, I was one of the first people, I guess, to really start to realize the tax challenges that people start to face That are
Early days, there were no tax challenges. Like, I'm not paying tax. That was the early days, right?
Well, I mean, even to this day, if you go on the IRS's website, 75% of people they're saying are non-compliant with their crypto taxes. So there is a large degree of non-compliance. And back then it was probably, I don't know the percentage, but much, much higher. But even back then, I mean, you know, there were people looking to be compliant. And there's always been people that want to be compliant, but there's a ton of other issues because the question starts to become, well, how is this taxed? How are we going to account for it? And just going about just, you know, getting all of those basics back then were very complicated for people that were even trying to get compliant. But, you know, my experience was, you know, when people did have gains, people were asking me even back then, what do we do about this for taxes? How does this work? And then there's a ton of misinformation online back then, and to a degree now less so, I would say, but still about, you know, the anonymous nature, where it's really pseudonymous, it's not anonymous, but people saying that you don't have to pay taxes on crypto and all of this stuff. So it really was a minefield back then, to a degree now it still is. But yeah, there's always been people that want to pay taxes, but there's a large degree of people that aren't as well.
I mean, I guess the point is that if you believe that Bitcoin is a currency, period, hard stop, you would have to believe that buying and selling Bitcoin is nothing more than buying and selling cash, dollars, right? You know, I take dollars out of the bank, I put them back in the bank. I take dollars out of the bank, I put them back in the bank. Right. That's the, you can go that route if you think that. I think that's ridiculous, but nonetheless, okay. And on the other hand, I think this people are probably think, well, crypto, that's the bucket. If I move from Solana to Dogecoin to ETH to Bitcoin, it's all in the same bucket, which obviously I'm not suggesting that's the case, but I can see where people may have wanted to believe that, right? I think that's the bottom line of it. I always thought, by the way, going back when, it's like, all right, I buy it and I sell it, I move it. Now, transfer is different. If I move it from this platform to that platform, and maybe that's because I came from a stock and bond and investment background, that I know that if I can move from Schwab to Interactive Brokers to Fidelity to Robinhood, I'm not changing anything by moving brokers. Now, if I change the investment itself outside of a qualified account, different discussion. So was that a confusing point for people, or it was just, they just didn't want to comply?
I think it's a confusing point, and it's even a point of contention to this day, because at the end of the day, you know, cryptocurrency and digital assets can take many different forms, and, you know, some may be securities, some may be collectibles, some may be entirely different asset classes. Some may be derivatives of existing asset classes. There's a lot of different forms that a cryptocurrency can take, and there, you know, different regulatory agencies are going to take different viewpoints on what they're classifying as. And it is confusing for people, first of all, because it's called a cryptocurrency, right?
Right.
And there's been tons of people that have gotten snared by this from a tax perspective, because how the IRS looks at it is as property. So when you trade one crypto for another, the way the IRS is looking at it is if you traded one piece of property for another, and, you know, there's no like-kind exchanges, which was a huge, you know, point of contention and confusion back in the early days. So yeah, you know, any crypto trade is taxable. And what I find in the early cycles, and even to this day, is that people aren't aware of that often. And, you know, they'll be trading crypto assets, crypto to crypto trades throughout a bull market, and maybe even taking profits into Bitcoin or Ethereum. And then when, you know, if a bear market comes, they're not realizing all of those trades that they made at peak valuations were taxable events. And, you know, if they were rolling all of their tax payments back into the market, they're going to have issues once it comes to tax time. So people do get ensnared by that. And it's even It's you know, a point of a big point of contention today that needs to get fixed.
Yeah.
A lot of people are trying to fix from a regulatory standpoint is that stable coins are.
Well, that's a whole different. I got a whole area on this. Can we just hold that for a second? Because I got a whole discussion.
The one thing I want to point out on that, though, is that it's their tax is property too. Just to tie that into that discussion, but we can't. Let's get to that more later.
Yeah, I want to stay back on where you were because I think it's also interesting, and I think our listeners, there's a lot of people out there that are working for the man. A lot of people that are working for a company that's not their own, and you made the leap. You left Deloitte to start your own firm, yeah. Right? So.
Yeah.
What, aside from the fact that you obviously made a killing on Bitcoin, but seriously, what was the tipping point on rationale for why you left? If you can discuss that, and the after effect of how that was for you.
Well, I always intended to start my own CPA firm, believe it or not. And for most of my life, I've actually intended to be a CPA, which a lot of people find that interesting as well. But, you know, I've wanted to basically be a CPA and own my own firm and, you know, take this entrepreneurial route since I was a very young man. And my whole intention behind it was to really pursue, you know, mastery in a career that could lead to a deep understanding of business and investment. So, you know, I can not only build a career and build a business, but build a deeper level of sophistication that could even extend me further, you know, as a businessman, as an investor, and as a human being. And, you know, that's really been my approach to everything. So, you know, it definitely was a big jump, you know, leaving the big four. It's, you know, that's a very good route to take. And, you know, many people I work with are still working there or have went on to work at, you know, other private companies. But, you know, my path was always really set on this. And it's definitely not for the faint of heart. It definitely was a huge risk that paid off. But, you know, if you want a larger payoff, I do believe you have to take a certain level of risk.
Yeah.
So. Luckily, you know, I guess that you could say I had the appetite for it to a certain degree, and I was dead set on it from a very, very early part of my life.
And it's paid off for you nicely. I mean, not all risks do pay off, but that I think is a really smart route. It's interesting because, you know, you talk about this whole idea of a profession, not only a profession, education that can get you to, because that's what you're talking about, right? You aren't talking necessarily about a profession. You're talking about an education that could bring you closer to business dealings and understanding the business world and understanding investments and opportunities. And in effect, I'm going to read through this for you and tell me if I'm way off on this, but in effect, allow you to understand and then make good choices in what that was, whether it was just an investment or whether it was maybe a business or maybe some other type of bigger investment, right? Is that the whole point?
Absolutely. You know, yeah, I started as, you know, a young man from, you know, modest beginnings from, you know, a small town in the Poconos in Pennsylvania and pursuing this route of accounting and becoming a CPA put me in Deloitte working for, you know, some of the largest investment managers in the world on Wall Street. It led to me, you know, having this motivation and drive to learn about all the financial systems, which led me to learning about precious metals, which basically led me to learning about Bitcoin in the early days. And, you know, it's kind of just defined the whole trajectory of my career and more or less the path that I took in my life. But it really started with this principle of, if I'm starting from square zero, how am I going to gain mastery from a business and investment perspective while building a career and becoming a professional?
So here's an important question. This could be the most important question of all the different podcasts we've done together and one today. How far were you from beautiful Mount Airy Lodge?
Oh, not far at all. not far at all.
Actually. Did you ever go there? I've been there. As a matter of fact, I saw Julio Iglesias perform at the beautiful Mount Airy Lodge in the Poconos.
No, I've personally never been there, but I do know exactly where it is. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great place.
Yeah.
Fine. So from New York, we would go down there. We'd go to the Poconos, right? We'd go to all these different areas. Yeah, we definitely go there. We definitely go to all the different hotels that were in the Poconos. There's a lot of a lot of good ones.
It's a good little place to get up to in the mountains from the city.
Yep. So when it comes to crypto taxation, regulation, so we've talked about this and there's been a progression and there's been more of a progression. So I want to hear the latest and greatest. How has the IRS been how has their approach to the crypto taxation discussion over the last few years and particularly more recently, how much of it's changed and what should investors do to prepare?
Well, firstly, I would say it's changed significantly this year, and this upcoming tax season are going to be huge from a compliance and enforcement standpoint. But really, it's just the next stage of maturity of what we've been seeing the IRS do with digital assets for the better part of a decade. And what I'm referencing is they are collecting tons of information on taxpayers' transactions. And, that's taken many forms historically via John Doe audits, international data sharing agreements, and other methods that are still used. And as a result of that, even this week, my firm has gotten dozens of inquiries from people that are receiving tax notices from the IRS. Where they've collected information and, they know they have transactions, it gets cross-referenced with their tax returns and they get a tax notice that basically says more or less in like layman terms, we know you don't have crypto. We know that we believe you may have not claimed all of your transactions related to cryptocurrency. There's tons of people getting those now. And then what we're going to see is this tax season for this year, the 1099 DAs are going to come out, which is a new tax form. It's kind of like a 1099 B for your brokers that you would get almost for securities, but it's the DA stands for digital assets. And this is going to be coming out for all centralized exchanges.
Let me just ask, is that going to be for holdings or for transactions? A 1099, for 1090 B is transaction based for, let's say, dividends, or there's an INT for interest, but B is for transactions. It gives you the buy, sells, and the nets and all that. There's some IRS forms that come out that just give you, I guess not a 1099, it's 1099s that give you the net. So they're going to then, just for transactions, if you do not transact, I assume you're not going to get.
No, if you're not transacting, I don't anticipate people getting. But this is going to get, going back to what we were saying with non-compliance, there is, according to the IRS, 75% non-compliance rate. That's publicly on their website. It's based off of, all this data collection they've already done. And I see it firsthand at my firm. When we're doing the crypto accounting for a new client, it is, the norm that we have to go back several years to reconstruct their cost basis and their accounting records. It's not uncommon to go back 5 to 10 years for a new client. There's tons of people that basically, another way to say it is they haven't done their crypto accounting since 2016, 2017, 2018, and they have to get it all caught up to get their basis accurate. So I'm seeing it firsthand. So there's this huge non-compliance rate, and now these 1099 DAs are going to come out for every person that has transactions on these centralized exchanges. So, what I expect, first of all, is, a lot of the people that are non-compliant are going to get ensnared in this just from just not filing and having matching errors due to that. The other issue is going to be people that even are filing may have matching issues if they don't file correctly and reconcile these 1099 DAs with their tax returns.
Or more important, or also if they transferred in from one firm to another, when you talk about non-matching, let me bring up the same thing, but differently said, is that the basis were never recorded properly. So now they're going to get,
The basis is a whole nother issue with the 1099 DAs. In fact, this year, they're not even required to report the basis. They're only going to be reporting proceeds, believe it or not. And it's going to be,
That's even more of a nightmare.
Yes, it is. And then it's going to become more of a nightmare when they have to actually share all this cost basis information, and the taxpayer is still going to have to report some of it to the exchanges because some of it will be held in non-custodial wallets. So it is going to be, you know, a minefield for people this year when they're navigating this. And if you're not doing not only proper accounting, but then proper reconciliation with the third party reporting, and then, you know, reporting that all appropriately on your return, you're going to have compliance issues. And, you know, again, I bring it back to the 75% non-compliance rate. Like, there's going to be tons of people that need to get this and then realize they need to go and update 5 to 10 years of their returns before they even can reconcile against the.
Now, what if you're not at a custodian? You're not at a online, we'll call it crypto broker.
You know, that's really interesting because this is a whole nother, you know, big debate and point of contention and, you know, a political football to a certain degree as well. The broker regulations that require these 1099 DAs to be reported, that they were proposed last summer. And at that time, it was to include non-custodial wallets and all these DeFi protocols like a Uniswap, for instance. And in the final broker regs, it actually made it through and they were going to be included. And then through a congressional action, they repealed it out of the final broker regs, the DeFi rules. So
they repealed what? They repealed the non-brokerage.
Non-custodial.
So that's just dumb. That's not consistent. That seems like somebody decided that it's a workaround and they can hold it in a cold wallet somehow, somewhere off line, if you will, and get away with something. Because otherwise, it makes no sense.
Well, regardless of which side you're on, like, the bottom line is it was included, and they pulled it back last minute through this congressional action.
Why would they do that? I'm asking you something. Why would they do that?
Because on the crypto side, they don't want to have to report all the wallets and KYC all the wallets. They don't want to disclose that information. And of course, on the regulatory side, they want it disclosed. So there was huge pushback within the industry. And then basically, you know, our industry lobbied the Trump administration pretty hard, and, you know, he got in and it got repealed. So, you know, whenever these administrations do change in the future, you can start to see that come back.
All I'm saying is, let me just restate my point. The only reason that would be repealed, if in fact there was a movement to make sure that transactions and cryptocurrency was taxed properly, the only reason why it would be repealed is people realize they can hide money that way from the aspect of taxation. Because there's no reason why one holding place versus another holding place is not includable in these requirements. That's my take.
Yeah. I mean, the argument from the crypto industry would be like they don't believe they have to disclose non-custodial wallet that's decentralized, that has no brokers, and they don't believe, like, you know, a decentralized protocol like Uniswap that is running without really centralized control, that it should have to report.
Let me just restate the overriding discussion is that worldwide income, if you are a U.S. citizen, is taxable, period, end of sentence.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, when we're doing someone's crypto accounting, we don't just do the exchanges. You have to include the wallets. And what happens is if someone does get into this idea of selective reporting, it's going to work to their disadvantage, either in the current tax year or a future tax year, because you'll have tax basis gaps. So really, you know, once you start having to report some things, you have to report everything, regardless of if there's third parties reporting on it. And it's you know, I've preached for years that it is an insane idea, you know, on the blockchain to commit tax fraud, because it is an immutable public ledger. There's no statute of limitations when it comes to tax fraud. And, you know, you do have to report your non-custodial wallets. And to people that may, you know, if you're transacting on a centralized exchange, they see your withdrawals to the wallet addresses. So this information is out there. And, you know, there's tons of tools, chain analysis tools to tie identities to people's wallet addresses. So it's not advisable. You know, earlier this year, well, it started last year with the indictment, but earlier this year, we saw the first person actually go to jail for a pure crypto tax evasion case. Richard Algren III, who underreported, I think, 3 or 4 years of returns related to cryptocurrency. It was maybe like 4 or 5 million. And, you know, he pled out to like two or three years in prison, I believe. He had to turn his private keys over to the IRS with all of his Bitcoin on it. And it's reported to be like $120 million worth of Bitcoin. So, you know, he's the first kind of like high profile case that was in the headlines related to this. There's another pending case where someone else was charged named Waylon Wilcox, who's an NFT trader, who's facing several counts of filing false tax returns filing false tax returns. So, you know, if you're going to commit tax fraud, you know, this information's sitting out there on the blockchain in perpetuity. So it's not advisable.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I see what you're saying, but overall there's huge industry pushback from the wallet perspective.
Of course. That's what I'm saying. Of course there is.
Yeah, but ultimately it's gonna get.
Of course, it's gonna catch up to them eventually. Right now, it's just, you know, we'll see what we can get away with and how far it can go. But if there is a standardization of the tax code with regard to crypto, it's gonna have to cover all crypto, all places for U.S. citizens. I'm talking about, right? That's what I'm talking about. So let's skip over. Can we just skip over to Web 3.0 and strategies and DAOs and I don't know where to begin with this, but. You have a business that is potentially, I guess, taking cryptocurrency as a form of payment. And yes. There's issues with regard to possibly, if you think about Web3, okay. So you have a standalone shop here in beautiful Mount Airy Lodge, decides to take Bitcoin, okay? And, okay, fine. That's, you know, in a state in the United States, blah, 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 fine. But now we talk about a web business, right? A Web 3.0 business maybe, or web, it doesn't really matter, right? And they start taking in through platform or just payment in terms of cryptocurrency. And there could be some multi-jurisdictional compliance issues on that, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's a big trend. There's a few big trends right now. One of them is, you know, stablecoin adoption and companies like PayPal and Square and others adopting blockchain rails to enable people accepting stablecoins and other cryptocurrencies for payment.
Mm-hmm.
When you start doing that, you know, you're going to have just the traditional tax considerations and accounting considerations that are going to get more complicated. But on top of that, you have sales tax and VAT tax considerations. And it's, you know, one of the most widely overlooked things industry-wide. I'm one of really the only people discussing this topic of on-chain sales taxes. It's something that, you know, is going to become a bigger issue in years to come. But obviously, you know, the focus right now is on the federal level. But I actually wrote a book on this topic related to on-chain sales taxes and NFT sales taxes, because I think it's going to be a huge issue. Because, you know, we were just talking about the non-compliance related to just regular income taxes. And this is even going to be a larger issue as we start to see these payment rails and more transactions from a commerce perspective start to proliferate. You know, when we saw the internet and e-commerce really start to grow 10, 15, 20 years ago, whatever it was, then people weren't collecting sales taxes back then outside of their home state. And there was a court case called the Wayfair court case And that required, you know, people to collect sales tax across state lines. Like when you go on an e-commerce site now, you know, you type in your address and they calculate sales taxes. So
we're right, because there's a long time, for a long time, we didn't have to pay taxes.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, it's kind of now the new frontier is on-chain. And people are not paying sales taxes on-chain. The level of non-compliance, there's over 31
states. Again, that doesn't make any sense to me. It just, well, first of all, you have to know what sales tax you're paying. That's an issue. I would assume you just do home state.
It's a huge challenge for people to comply. There's over 31 states right now that tax digital products and goods and NFTs and, you know, other types of transactions that are happening on chain likely fit into these definitions. We've seen several states actually give guidance related to NFTs. Washington's interim guidance came out years ago. It's the most detailed, but several other states, Pennsylvania being one of them, they've included NFTs in their definition, taxable digital products and goods. So it's another huge area of tax exposure for the industry.
You know what I find really funny in the industry? You know, you tell me how difficult it is and who knows what it is. Everybody knows you sell something, generally speaking, a product of some sort, you pay tax. Services, to a degree, depending on what the services are, you may have to pay a tax, right? That's kind of generally common knowledge, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
And you got some of the smartest people in this industry, and you're telling me that it's a challenge. Meanwhile, they create a currency out of thin air, okay? And they put this on this blockchain thing, which is this immutable ledger, blah, 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 this whole thing, right? And they go on and on, and they have almost religious ceremonies about the importance and how great this is. And you're telling me they can't figure out what state gets the money when the transaction comes through? It just makes no sense to me.
I've been preaching this issue for years, the sales tax issue.
They don't want to pay it. They don't want to do it. That's the bottom line. But, you know, if they have this, they create this technology that's unbelievable where you put on glasses and you're immersed in a VR thing and there's money coming in from Roblox bucks or whatever, you know, I'm not blaming them, but, you know, that kind of thing. And you're telling me they can't figure out the taxes payable to a state upon sale? Seriously. Come on. It seems a little bit far-fetched to me.
I agree with you in the sense that, you know, if the industry wants to reach the next stage of maturity, these issues have to get
right. They got to put their big boy pants on and be a business, not this other thing they're trying to play with. By the way, you mentioned the next frontier. I want to mention that you have, to everybody out there, that you have something called the Financial Frontier Podcast, starring Pat Camuso. And you had recently, back in June, you talked about stablecoins and the future of finance. And in July, you talked about, you had the guest on Umar from The Accountant Quits. You talked about mastering the fundamentals of Web3 accounting and talked about subledger setups and compliance. And in August, you had an episode titled, very long episode title, by the way. I try to keep it to three words. You don't seem to care about this. Navigating Crypto Taxes for Investors and Professionals with Sheehan, which, by the way, has a long last name. I'm going to try Chandra Sekara from CoinTracker. And you talked about IRS enforcement, tax strategies, audit proof systems, et cetera. So cool stuff. The Financial Frontier Podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And we have some very interesting episodes coming out, one of which is with one of the former executive directors of the IRS that actually really, you know, assisted with some of the, or really oversaw the digital asset broker regulations. Other episodes with people that are working with senators and lobbying efforts related to some of these crypto tax issues that we're discussing. So there are going to be some interesting episodes coming
out. Let's go backwards here to some of the other things, or not backwards, go into some of the things I want to talk about. Stablecoins. Let's talk about stablecoins. Shall we talk about stablecoins? Because it's all the rage right now. What I find also interesting, so the oxymoron, the juxtaposition, the funny beating down on old Fi, you know, grandpa Fi, you know, the same people that are coming on the various news channels, social medias, and saying things like, you know, oh, can you imagine not being able to transact on a weekend because your bank is closed? And by the way, I don't know about you. You could send me money through Zelle You can give me cash. There's plenty of ways for you to do things on the weekend. And the earliest form of digital currency, by the way, I don't want to freak anybody out here, but was a credit card, which you could use at any given time that would charge your account, etc. Now, that's not as fancy as we want to talk about with a cryptocurrency. I get it. But the idea of utilizing a transaction-based currency of some sort on anytime, anywhere, let me tell you, I can call up Moldavia any time of the night and book a hotel room and use a credit card. I'm certain of it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I do think stablecoins in other countries are a way where they're able to get dollars and maybe get better, less fees and more just...
No, I got that. I'm just saying that what I want to talk about, though, was the interesting thing where I was going to bring this one more point as I got through this, the strange same people that hate OldFi, right? That's the whole crypto believers, right? Wouldn't you agree? You know, OldFi is like, you know, it's like...
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Okay. So those same people, these guys now are coming, Gemini, Winklevoss, they're coming on OldFi with their rug pulls, with their IPOs, and they're running it up. Gemini came out, what did I say earlier? I said it came out, ran up to what, 40-something? It's back. It's below its IPO price now. You know, you look at Circle, did great, by the way. That's a stablecoin company. I found it fascinating. A stablecoin company is coming to OldFi for financing. How weird is that?
There's definitely emerging right now of TradFi and the Web3 world. Even if you go to crypto conferences this past year, there's a lot more of a professional presence, I would say.
So yeah, but it's funny because they're willing to take it now. They realize that it's, you know, they're not going to displace. They may disrupt, they may add on to, but displacement is pretty, it's futile, as they would say in Star Trek. And I think that they realize there's a lot of money out there that they can have access to if they comply with the fact that, okay, we're an add-on. They don't need to be the replacement of. They could be, there's plenty of room in the world for all of this. That's my point.
Yeah, look, from what I see, the industry wants adoption. And if you want wider adoption, particularly from, you know, institutions and even just, you know, mainstream retailers, it's going to require acceptance from regulators, and that's going to require a certain level of compliance. And, you know, taking the approach of just kind of throwing your hands up and not working with anyone just creates a vacuum that's unlikely to be to your advantage. That's kind of the way I see it. So yeah, I mean, you know, the Bitcoin conference is almost like a political conference now to a certain degree,
as opposed to a religious one.
It's a way different tone the past couple of years, and not just that one, you know, many others. So it's changing, and there's definitely a focus now in DC on crypto, and there's, you know, the crypto industry has descended on DC, and we're going to see a lot of changes and a lot of maturity. And with that's going to come regulatory clarity, but, you know, more requirements for compliance.
But let's talk about stablecoins, because stablecoins are often seen as this, I guess, a bridge maybe, or some kind of connector between TradFi and crypto, NewFi, DeFi, FiFi, FutureFi. So is this, let's back it up. The stable coins of yesterday, right? We had what, the Terra, the Luna, that was kind of these algorithmic stable coins that were promising always 15%. By the way, you're a young guy. I've been in this business a long time. You start hearing that 15% number. I don't know what that magic number is, but 15% is always the number that is like, oh crap, get me out of here. That was the Madoff number. Madoff always made 15% per year annual. That's what he guaranteed you. And that's what these stable coins did. And then when I heard that, it kind of made my ears wiggle, right? And they did eventually go belly up and people in jail and all that good stuff.
And tons of people lost a lot to that.
So the stable coins of today are usually what, non-interest bearing, just currency, or some may have interest to a bit, but generally speaking, they're used as currency. That's the point, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have to look at each individual one, and quite frankly, there's more that are coming up every day. And
but do we need all these? Can't we just have a couple? What do we need all of them for? If it's a stable coin, it's supposed to do what a stable coin is supposed to be, a stable coin. What, you know, it's different than all these other deals of where the project based, or it was, you know, could be built upon, or, you know, whatever, right? I get all those other ones that, you know, Chamath Palihapitiya put on the backs of napkins as the best deal ever, or whatever, right? Or Doge. I get the meme coins and all that. But why do we need so many stable coins?
You know, I think it's not why do we need so many stable coins. It's more that, you know, any major player in the space is gonna want to control the rails, the payment rails, and, you know, get the fees, the data, and the leverage that comes with it. And based off of the market positioning of different groups in the space that may control liquidity, for instance, or have some sort of regulatory arbitrage, or even, you know, potentially countries that have like geopolitical power, they're in a position to where they can potentially, you know, launch something and benefit from that. So I think that's kind of like why you see so many. And then, you know, that's also why people are using different ones too.
So I guess what's going to end up happening, like it usually happens, is something's going to rise to the top, and the rest of the stuff is maybe gone. May not be like an investment gone, like it's done, but it's just, you know, not used very much. Because essentially, if you want to have a stable coin that is really a stable coin, which is a world currency, because that's what you want of a stable coin, don't you? Don't you want a world stable, a world currency that can be easily transacted? It's less, very little friction. It's low cost. It's available wherever, right? Like, you know, that's why you have all these other payment plans. You have TransferWise, you have PayPal, you have Block, you have this, whatever, Square, you know, all these different Visa, MasterCard, US dollars, Wire, Swift. You have all these different possible payment methodologies. The whole point, I would seem, if I was to be the god of stablecoins, is to have one stablecoin that was accepted around the world. Doesn't that seem like the way you want to do it?
Well, I mean, you know, it comes down to the argument of like, do you want, I guess, more decentralization, or do you just want to have one currency? Because ultimately you have to, whoever's behind that stable coin, you know, has more control and leverage.
So why do we care? Do we care? I mean, again, for a stable coin, I'm not talking about other currencies that you can, you know, cryptos that you could use, but for a stable coin, I thought the point of a stable coin was to have in other words, you make a global stable coin consortium that has, I don't know, continent based, let's call it, okay, for lack of a better discussion, Pat. And, you know, you have a voting party that, I don't know, maybe there's some kind of a blockchain voting something or other that votes the committee members in by, you know, you do like instead of America's Got Talent, you know, you do stable coins got talent, and you vote them in to that position for what they do, right? And or for that matter, have it as the UN. I don't know, something like that. It seems to me, I just don't. It just seems to me this whole idea of this, you know, the decentralization, is it really that important for a stable coin at the end of the day? Well, it can't be fully centralized like one. I get that. I understand that. And it can't be one company, one country, whatever. But it seems to me that somewhere in between that, maybe a hybrid approach, if there's such a thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's an argument that's going to continue on because there's definitely the argument to have like one centralized currency, but not everyone's going to trust that. Not everyone even trusts any of the one stable coins that are out there right now. You know, if you look at like Tether, for instance, some people use that, some people don't. Others distrust Circle, and, you know, not everyone would trust a stable coin that's even necessarily controlled by one nation state or a group of them potentially. So those are also probably going to pop up, but will there be other stable coins that are, you know, privately issued? It seems to be that way, you know, but I've seen, and, you know, maybe the industry changes, but, you know, there's tons of fragmentation at so many different levels in this industry, you know, with different blockchains, with different type users, the different types of transactions that are going to be taking place. And, you know, different regulatory environments within different jurisdictions. All these things start to create ways where, you know, there's differentiation and people can launch.
Well, I'm sure we're going to have the whole issue.
All that gets standardized one day, possibly.
I mean, I'm sure we're going to have the same ongoing discussion from square one of a stablecoin, a cash equivalent. Is it a digital asset? That whole thing, and from not only a personal perspective, but also from a tax treatment. Because that's a big issue. Stablecoin, in my opinion, should be a cash transaction. If it's always maintains the same value, if it doesn't change value, I have no problem with no taxes on it.
Yeah, this is a mess right now. It's one of the things that I believe is a political topic when it comes to crypto taxes. It's actually something I'm talking about on my podcast soon. It's the stablecoin taxes because they're all taxable events because stablecoins are looked at as property right now. So it's a huge tax issue. It's also a huge accounting issue in terms of you know, how should stablecoins be presented on the balance sheet, whether it's as an intangible or as cash. So, you know, the tax issue just creates just reporting requirements that shouldn't really have to exist, I would say. Of course, if you're disposing of Bitcoin for a stablecoin, you should have to claim the Bitcoin disposition. But there's no reason that if you're selling USDC, that's a stablecoin that's going to be within 99 cents for a dollar, that we need to go and place an administrative burden both on the taxpayers and the IRS to have to process all these transactions of people's stablecoins. I think that's something that has to change. But right now, it's a huge issue because they are just falling under the definition of property.
One of the things I like about the stablecoin the most is that if you have it backed by, let's say, U.S. Treasuries, which again is there again is that merger between, you know, called OldFi, but OldFi and NewFi, right? That there's a very interesting point there because the stablecoin has to be backed by something, and that was the big issue with Tether for many years, right? What are they really backed by? Is it really because they couldn't figure out what was really backing all this? But when you look at the various coins out there in the stablecoin environment, they are to be backed. Now, if they are backed by treasuries, what does that mean? The more people that adopt the stablecoin, the more treasuries they have to buy. That keeps the United States fully liquid, or whatever particular country they use the treasuries from. But many of them are backed by U.S. treasuries.
It supports the U.S. dollar. I would agree with you there for sure.
Right. So it's a benefit too, right?
Yeah,
it's a benefit
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely.
It's a benefit
and
too.
That's why you're starting to see this administration, you know, is friendly to it, and we're starting to see more regulations come out related to stable coins and digital assets, because I do think it's a strategy that's getting adopted at that level.
Yeah, what's really funny about it also is if they go against it, because there's a lot of money in stable coins right now, and that means the exact equivalent, theoretically, the exact equivalent amount that's in stable coins that are backed by U.S. treasuries are backed by U.S. treasuries. You follow what I'm saying? There's that much. Yeah. So the load that's being used to be, can you imagine, by the way, if there wasn't stablecoin for a second holding up treasuries, we may have had to actually have higher rates than we have now. There could be an artificially lower rate right now due to the fact that we have all this money in treasuries in stablecoins than if they weren't 5 years ago, let's say.
It's like a pressure release valve almost.
Yeah. Or a guaranteed buyer.
Exactly.
A guaranteed buyer, which used to be, right, which is a good reason for the administration to actually like them if they don't do any of the algorithmic or the leveraged type of work on it, because leverage, that would screw, you know, obviously.
Exactly. And that's why stablecoins are such a big idea, because it's really, you know, this first case of where, you know, the industry's created a product that is able to like interface and fit in with the traditional financial system, more or less.
Yep.
And you're seeing the impact of it. You're just starting to, really.
Yep. Well, we gave everybody where to find you in terms of your podcast and how to get to that. And we're going to put information about who you are, where you are, how to get you on the episode show notes on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, episode number 939. What episode number are you on? Let's see.
Sheesh, man.
Not that.
I don't know if I don't count every single one of them like that. Maybe, I mean, I don't even think probably around 50 or so episodes. 50.
You'll get there once you get to be my age.
Nowhere close to that. I respect that number. That's great.
Thanks for joining me, Pat Camusa. We'll have you on again soon. Anything that's late breaking, I need to know, get it over to me. We'll get it on here. All right.
Absolutely. I appreciate it.
Thanks. That's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Make sure to listen to DH Unplugged, where myself and John C. Dvorak, well, we talk about the hardcore news and what it really means to every one of us. I also have a great guest coming up on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Wilkinson's next week. We got Robbie Miles. We got Tom Nelson. And it just goes on and on the list when we look at all the great people that'll be here. You know, looking at Howard Lindzen, Vitaly Katsanelson, a great list. Anyway, thanks for joining me this week and every week. Go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check out all that there is to offer you over there. Thank you so much. I'll see you again real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.